Welcome to Project Chatter, the podcast where PPM experts from various sectors talk about the latest trends. Listen to Val and Dale as they talk about tried and tested best practices and share their unfiltered thoughts about the industry. Whether you're here to learn how to progress your career, improve your project control skills, or just want to hear an Aussie and South African rant about projects, then you've come to the right place. Welcome to the Project Chatter podcast with your hosts, Dale Fung and Val Matthews.
Let's go. In this week's pod, we were joined by Adrian Dooley to discuss breaking down barriers to implementation of good practice and a little bit of ChatGPT. Originally a project manager in construction, Adrian held various roles in the project management for over 45 years. Holy moly, that's older than me. He was part of the team that created one of the first project scheduling software packages and was founding member of the first independent project management magazine, Project Manager Today.
He founded the Projects Group, a training and consultancy company, and served on the executive council of the APM. He's a non-executive director of the APM Group and the lead author of the Praxis Framework. So, Val Martin, we went around a few topics with Adrian, and it was great, the anecdotes he had. There were some funny stories in there. I love the fact that he just brought it back to basics and reminded us about things like checklists and how important those are. But it was good just to kick the tires on Adrian's experiences and, you know, bringing a bit challenging, I guess, the current training techniques, where they're all based on more theory or knowledge than anything else. But what were some of the things that stood out for you, Martin?
Yeah, I thought it was an interesting challenge on AI, just given, you know, how much it's shifting towards that. And, you know, he was very passionate about the existing learning and really doing the basics. He mentioned the Monday morning problem, and I really liked his one at the end about a pre-match training anecdote. So no spoilers. Val, how about you? What were your main takeaways?
Yeah, it's just refreshing to hear someone talk about the foundations and the fundamentals again. In despite of all this technology, it still won't solve the barriers or problems that we have in projects. But also like the fact that he's very well versed in some of the new technology as well. So he's a very knowledgeable guy.
Yeah, absolutely. And before we go, gents, we have to sort of wish Project Chatter Podcast a happy 4-year-old birthday, because we missed it in November. November is our birthday month. So we're 4 years old, gents, and almost at the end of season 7. Any thoughts on the past 4 years, Val?
No, only that it just goes quick. Probably because I'm not on all the podcasts anymore, but it's been a ride, and thanks, gents, for entertaining me for so many years.
Yeah, awesome. Martin, what are your thoughts on the past 4 years?
Yeah, again, it's the guests that make it. I know we say it at the end of season wrap-ups, but yeah, just the amazing diversity of guests, and it's just brilliant having a front row seat and being able to ask them questions that you just wouldn't normally be able to do. So yeah, here's to the next 4 years.
Absolutely. We'll keep going. We'll keep bringing you those experts the next 40. Who knows if we're going to live that long. But anyway, we'll keep going. We've got one more episode after this one before we wrap up the year and the season. So look out for the final one, folks. And as we say, keep listening, keep liking, and keep paying it forward.
Hello, project people. Welcome back to a brand new episode of the Project Chatter Podcast. And it's good to have you with us. And it's good to have a full team back from the UK and Australia live here with you today. Mr. Dale Fung, how are you, sir?
I'm very good, Val. It's good to have you back as well. I think people have started rumors that we don't like each other because you did the last one on your own, the one before myself and Martin did without you. But no, we will break those rumors. They're not true. We do love each other. We're all back in the same virtual room.
We are, and it's just a matter of managing this and managing projects. But we can get into that a bit later. Martin, how are you, sir? Good to see you as well.
Yeah, good, thanks. Yeah, good to have you back.
Man of many words, Mr. Martin, but I'm sure you'll get into it a bit later. And our guest for today obviously doesn't need an introduction, but let's introduce him anyway. Mr. Adrian Dooley. How are you, sir?
I'm very well, thank you.
Very good to hear from you. Now, look, this is the first time we've had you on, but you've been around the blocks a few times in terms of projects. So we always usually like start with some soft, easy questions, and then Martin throws in some hammers. But before we do, Adrian, how did you get into projects? Where did it all start for you?
Well, I went to university to do a degree in building, and that basically is projects. There's no other way of building stuff than by projects. So I didn't think of it as being projects or project management. I just turned up to learn how to build stuff and got into project management that way.
Yeah, brilliant. And that was a very succinct, humble kind of starting from what I understand. You've contributed a lot to the project community. So look, let's get into the subject matter today. We're talking about breaking down the barriers of good practice. What are some of the observations in terms of barriers you've experienced over the many years you've been on projects?
Well, I suppose I need to establish that there are barriers first. Why do I think there are barriers? And generally, when I start talking about this, I start off with a quotation from about 30 years ago. I don't know if you've come across it. It's called Cobb's Paradox. Have you heard of that? Martin Cobb was a guy at the Treasury Board of Canada, and he came up with this statement, which people who know more about this than I do tell me is not a true paradox. But there you go. It's known as Cobb's Paradox, so I'll go with it. He said, we know why projects fail. We know how to prevent their failure. So why do they still fail? And that actually opens up a big can of worms about, well, what exactly is project failure? Do we really know how to prevent it? And all that kind of stuff. So over the course of, 45 years now, I've been involved in project management in a whole range of different ways, from managing big projects to being a journalist about them to consulting and training and a whole range of stuff. And over that period, I just started collecting anecdotal evidence, stuff I observed. A good example, perhaps, is the interminable surveys you get on LinkedIn at the moment, but you know, pre-LinkedIn, you got them in magazines and marketing material. Everybody loves a survey. Two types of survey. One is what percentage of projects fail. And a quick search on LinkedIn recently showed me that all the learned surveys on what percentage of projects fail come up with results of between 15 and 80%. So I think we can pretty much rely on the fact that those statistics are not really worth the paper they're written on. The methodologies of the research are all over the shop. There's a whole load of stuff in there that they don't tell you. And going back to the days when I ran a project management magazine and every consultancy wanted to do an article on what percentage, starting with some enormous percentage of projects that fail, it's really just a hook to get you involved in what they want to sell. The other kind of survey is the causes of project failure. Now, the first example of that I've got is from the proceedings of the IPMA conference in 1972. I wasn't there. I was doing my GCSEs about then, I think. But at a conference in 1972, they came out with a list of reasons why projects fail. And it's pretty much identical to one I saw on LinkedIn last week. And everyone I've seen in between has been pretty much the same. And
what are the causes, Adrian? Are they?
Well, they come up with things like not enough planning up front, not enough requirements capture. They come up with the same sort of things time after time. But my point here is they're not the causes of project failure. They're the symptoms of project failure. And what we need to get to the bottom of is what causes those things to happen. So that's what I became very interested in. What are the root causes? Not what is this list of symptoms that doesn't change year after year after year. So that's what's got me into it, is the premise that there must be some barriers that are stopping us applying good practice. What are those barriers?
Yeah. Yeah. I've seen the same level of research, and there's obviously been a lot of people. Yeah, please go.
Douglas Adams, you know Douglas Adams, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, said some incredibly insightful and humorous things at the same time. And his quote is, human beings who are almost unique in having the ability to learn from the experience of others are also remarkable for their apparent disinclination to do so. So, you know, I thought there's something in that. It's going back to Cobb's paradox. We probably do know how to prevent project failure, but there are reasons why we're not doing it. So what are those reasons? And that's what sent me off on the path that I'm currently on.
Yeah. No, it's great. I'm glad there's someone doing it, Adrian, because there are a lot of people out there boasting a lot of statistics around projects failing, and I'm sure it must be demoralizing for project managers to always hear that we're not doing well, and then not really know why we're not doing well, because I think everyone kind of suggests that they have a silver bullet to fixing projects, but it doesn't seem year on year we're getting any better at it. So you mentioned you've been collecting anecdotal data and observations of your own from projects. So in terms of barriers then, if all of the, I guess, the results that are currently being published are symptoms, then what, where has your root cause led you, Adrian? Let's start there.
I suppose it's difficult to give you sort of succinct observations. These are impressions that grew up over a period. As I say, in the early days, I was a construction project manager. After that, I got into software development and ended up developing the first piece of project management software that was adopted by Apple as their under their own label. And that got me involved. That got me interested in areas other than construction. Then I went into training consultancy, launched a magazine called Project Manager Today, and ended up talking to a whole range of different people. And probably, you know, the things I've seen come and go, the fads, as you say, the fashions. Probably mid 90s, we got into this where everybody needs a certification. So there was an awful lot of training going on. And picking up from all those different things, I thought the good practice is out there. There's a lot of people who know it. Why isn't it being applied? And one of the things that really brought it to a head was I got involved in a lot of consultancy around lessons learned, which comes back to that thing about Douglas Adams. You know, we have the ability to learn from others. And if we collect lessons learned, then hopefully the next generation get a bit better and the generation after that get a bit better still. And I was working for a very large regulated infrastructure business in the UK. And we were setting up a knowledge management system, which included collecting, classifying and making available all their lessons learned. So I started looking through some of these things. I couldn't believe what I was reading. Now, knowing that we'd get onto this subject, I've just got a couple here to make sure I quote them correctly. And I should say, first of all, these are not from that company I talked about. These are from government and non-governmental organisations that we obtained under Freedom of Information. So I hope everybody's listening carefully, because I'm now going to enable you to make sure every project you ever run in the future, it succeeds with this incredibly insightful advice. Just two pieces. Number one, involve business stakeholders from the start. Clever, isn't it? You didn't think of that. Number two, having a formal business case would have been beneficial. So knowing what you want and involving the important people, you know, these, in a lot of these documents that I was trying to collate, are the lessons that should be learned. Now, I've got a whole list of those. You know, I'm just giving you those two to give you a flavour of it. So you look at those and you think, can any of you name a single course which doesn't include stuff like that on the first day? This is such basic stuff. And if you accept that lessons learned reports are going to give you an insight in why projects aren't going very well in organizations, you can simply phrase that as organizations are spending hundreds of thousands, millions of pounds on training people who are going on courses, sometimes getting a certification as a result of being on those courses. And they're then not doing what they're told they should be doing on day one of the course. So that sort of led me to one of these barriers, in that I call it Monday morning. So, you know, if we put it in the context of people doing training courses, and perhaps if I can give you a little anecdote there. In the mid-80s, I did a lot of training on software, project planning software. And the big one in the mid-80s was called SuperProject. Now, I turned up to do a SuperProject course one day. Guy walked through the door, and is, as is often the case, when you deal with an awful lot of people and a lot of turnover, he walked in and I recognized the face. I thought, I know that face. I don't know his name. I can't remember where we've met before. So, you know, you've got to own it. And I said, look, I'm really sorry. I know we've met before. I recognize you, but I can't remember where from. He said, I came on this course 6 weeks ago, but the company didn't buy the computer and the software for me to actually use everything you told me. So it's 6 weeks later. I've forgotten it all. So here I am again. Start from scratch. Right. Okay. So you bring that back to what I was saying about people go on a course, usually for a week, maybe taking an exam on Friday morning, hopefully pass it. And they've got their head is crammed with all this knowledge, which they've shown they've retained for a couple of days at least by passing the exam. And they're drained. You know, it was a heavy week. So they go home Friday night, have a tot, good night's sleep, have a good weekend, go into work on Monday morning. What happens on Monday morning? Pile of emails, queue of people knocking on the door. And how do they manage the projects that they've learned now so much about? Same way I always did. Because they don't have the space, the support, the anchors to try and apply all this stuff that they've just learned. Have you come across something called Ebbinghaus's forgetting curve? Ebbinghaus, German psychologist in the 19th century, did some experiments that said, you know, you forget 20% of what you've learned after 24 hours. You forget another 10% after another 24 hours. So there's this parabolic curve. I think it's parabolic, or is it exponential? I don't know, but it's a curve. And it goes down and tails off. And people forget stuff. If they don't apply it, they don't get the chance to apply it, they forget it. And so on Monday morning, they don't get the chance to apply it. That accelerates the forgetting curve. And all this good stuff gets forgotten, doesn't get applied for cultural reasons, usually. And 6 months later, project's not going very well, lessons learned. Well, if we'd had a business case, that would have been very useful. Do you think? What's the point? We put all this investment into training and it's not making a difference.
In your view, what are some of the reasons for that? Because not, you know, none of this is exactly new stuff. You know, you've probably seen it over the course of your career. We know that people forget stuff. You know, I just had to Google that the forgetting curve, and you know, it's years old. Yeah, just why do you think it's not happened? Like you're saying, it's the reality. The emails pile up, but you know, companies they spend a lot of money in investing in these things. The people who are business leaders have probably even been on these courses 10 years before.
I don't know. I think if you're fairly high up in an organization, these kind of training courses are a bit beneath you. It's the kind of thing you send other people on. But having invested in sending them on these courses, you then don't give them the time and the space and the support they need to actually implement the stuff that you've just paid for them to learn. And I think this is fairly, this particular barrier of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 I've got now, this particular one is fairly clear. It happens all the time. You can see it happening. There was a UK health, national health conference 3 years ago, I think. And one of the ladies who was presenting, she said, I find it really difficult to apply the stuff I learn on courses, because applying that stuff means you've got to change the way you do things. And it's difficult to change the way you're doing things when you're under such pressure to just keep peddling the hamster wheel. And I say, you need some space. You need a pause. You need, okay, right. We should have a business case. Then we understand what it is we're trying to achieve. And if I can slip in another anecdote, because I love anecdotes. I was doing some consultancy. I'm going to have to be careful here not to name names. I was doing some consultancy a few years back for a FTSE top 100 organization who were undertaking the biggest program of change they'd ever undertaken. I think the value was about 10 billion. And I was on the peer review group who looked at how the different programs were going and asked, hopefully, penetrating questions and all the rest of it. And after one of these peer reviews, the guy overarching in charge, he said to me, look, could you run a workshop for our benefits managers so that they understand the importance of realizing the benefits that are set out? I said, yeah, of course, no problem. So we agreed a date. I turned up, sort of very ad hoc. So it's a workshop. I'm not going to lecture them. Let's just talk about stuff and how they can best realise the benefits of this £10 billion programme of change. So I said, OK, guys, let's start with the business case. You know, you're the business change managers, the benefits managers. You've got to realise the benefits set out in the business case. So, in your own words, explain to me what's in the business case. Their unanimous response was, finance won't let us see it. It's too confidential. I think, okay, how does that work? So, yeah, they go on courses, they have workshops, but they're not trusted with the information that they need to do that job. That's an extreme and very unfortunate case. You know, when we're talking about the hundreds, thousands of people who go on basic courses, You know, they, on Monday morning, they understand the business case is necessary. By the time they dealt with all the rubbish that's accumulated over the week they're away, then they just don't have the power, the time, the opportunity to say, look, guys, you know, we need to do more about having business cases and workable business cases. And you need to understand that if I say I don't think this business case is viable, then we need to talk about it. It's very sad.
You mentioned lessons learned earlier, and you know, at the moment we've got the COVID inquiry, so that's a kind of major lessons learned for the whole country, so to speak. But during the course of your career, have you seen any kind of shift in the types of lessons that companies or major programs are learning? So, you know, apart from the obvious, just how it's kept, technology, that kind of thing. But is there any shift in, you know, since the 80s to present day in the types of lessons? We all, you know, we talked many, many times about the reasons for project failure, and you've always brought it up. It's the same list, maybe a different order. But what have you seen in terms of those lessons learnt?
The simple answer to that is no. And I think that is
interesting.
Well, if the kind of lessons we were learning had evolved over time, then you would expect. Well, I've got to be. I'm sure somebody will be listening to this and saying, "Hang on a second, a lesson learned is not the same as a lesson acted upon." And in far too many cases, yeah, we record lessons learned because we know we are human and we have the unique ability to learn from the experience of others. But do we actually do anything with it? Do we actually do anything about it? You know, any method for managing projects will say right up front, you need to check the lessons learned that are available to you so that you're not making the same mistakes on the next project. And I don't think many people have the opportunity or the access to that kind of information. And what that means is there isn't the evolution.
Do you think technology can help with this? So when I say technology, you know, AI seems to be the big buzzword at the moment. Is that something that can help? Because, you know, I'm hearing a lot of negativity here. There's a lot of good people doing some really good work, and you know, some of them may even listen to us. But in your view, what can we do going forward? What's your kind of pitch apart from just do what the courses say?
I think AI has enormous potential, and I'm working with a guy called Martin Paver to try and realise that potential. It also, and I don't mean this in some sort of apocalyptic way, just in a practical day-to-day managing projects way, it also has the ability to do great damage. About half an hour before we started talking, sad git that I am, I was on LinkedIn. So 7:30 in the evening, I thought, oh yeah, there's a post there that somebody I know has commented on. Let's have a look at it. And somebody posted a 50-page learned document on project methodologies. And these project management methodologies that it was talking about were Scrum, Agile, Waterfall, all of which, of course, are not methodologies. And reading it, I recognised the kind of stuff it was coming out with. So I'm going to name names here of companies, not people. A little while back, there was a bit of fuss about an article published by Forbes. Now, Forbes, a credible source of information a big, long-standing organization, you read stuff they produce, you would trust it. So they published a document which said, Scrum is a project management methodology. Kanban is a project management methodology. Agile and Waterfall are project management methodologies. And when a few of us looked into that, the two people that had been commissioned to write it had no experience of projects whatsoever. And they admitted that they just used AI to write the article. AI had picked up a load of misinformation, a load of rubbish on the internet, because surprise, surprise, there's actually a lot of rubbish information on the internet. AI had picked that up. Forbes had used it in this ill-informed article and published it under the Forbes name. So, of course, what will happen is AI will come along and say, oh, that's from Forbes. That's really reliable. I'll give that a higher level of credibility. And that will continue until this information disappears up its own interface, because AI is just going to amplify it all the way through. So what a few of us felt was that if AI is going to work, we need to feed it with some good information. So we need to talk to people we respect, get hold of information, not necessarily all saying the same thing, but all being valid views, even if they are slightly different. Collect all this information, feed it into a large language model, and say, yeah, this is reliable information. This is not going to feed you garbage. This is not going to make a statement. For example, you know, and I use this because it's not debatable. This is beyond question. The process groups in the PMI's body of knowledge, so edition 6 and prior, are process groups. They are not project lifecycle phases. And I can't tell you off the top of my head, but I've noted it to a number of people. It says it in paragraph 7 on page XXX. These are the process groups. They are not lifecycle phases. If you ask ChatGPT to give you a life cycle of a project, it will quote the PMBOK process groups, because that's the drivel it's picked up from so many people who posted that. And Forbes picked that up. And AI thinks Forbes is really good without knowing that Forbes got it from the AI in the first place. And so the cycle goes on. So, yes, AI has enormous potential, but it also has, it has the potential to be really bad as well as really good. And we need to grab
that. That's a good point.
And lean on the beneficial side.
I was just going to ask, Adrian, is there, I get the point of feeding good information in, because we know on projects, garbage in, garbage out. But who's going to train at what's right versus what's wrong? This is the other thing that I find interesting, is someone wants to control the information going in as well. And that also presents two problems, or one problem and one opportunity. How do we also get away from feeding it just biased views? Because if you take some of the publications out, and Bent Flifberg will be all over this, is, you know, he thinks some of the barriers for project failure is human bias. How do we also look at that from a AI perspective, from your understanding?
First of all, let me say it's really early days. We've just started. We're not entirely sure what the correct path is. We're just having a go and see what we can achieve. We started off with government guidance. So you go to the in the States, it's the GAO, the Government Administration Office. So they have a tome like that about earned value. The APM in the UK have some publications on earned value. There is, I'm trying to remember, AACE, I think they've got some guidance on earned value. And they don't all align exactly with each other. But if we take those trusted sources, even if they don't, in a way, it's good if they don't agree with each other exactly, because one of the things about AI is you can ask it to compare and contrast. And you feed those in. We put out various calls for people to recommend documentation. I've started talking to some publishers, and this is one of the tricky ones, because a lot of the good stuff is not free, and it's not on the internet. Books, yeah, basically what I'm saying. A lot of people have written some really good books. So the question here is, can we talk to those people and convince them that what we're doing is for the benefit of the profession, and find a way in which they will if you allow their IP, and I'm told the correct phrase here is to be ingested. So they give us their IP to be ingested into the model. That doesn't mean somebody can get their book for free. It means that the AI will draw on that knowledge in order to give a sensible answer. And I hope that the AI will say, well, there's this way of looking at it and there's this way of looking at it. And it's up to you to work out what's the best approach for you. What I don't want it to do is just to scrape the internet and come up with, you know, rubbish like Scrum is a project management methodology.
Yeah.
Adrian, have you ever used ChatGPT to debate with itself?
No, not
debate. So you asked it a question, right? Yeah, you ask it a question and gives you an answer. Let's say it gives you those, you know, those processes as life cycle stages, and then you just ask it to critique its last answer. And yeah. I think Val, you and I have discussed this quite a lot, right? It's with AI, and I think this is what you're getting to, Adrian, is that a lot of it is about the prompt. It's how you ask it. Mm-hmm. And the context you give it, because it can give you anything. It'll give you anything. You can give it three words, or even two words, or one word, and it'll give you something, right? It'll give you an output. It'll make it up. It is generative AI. It'll make something up for you. But whether it's the right thing or not, and this is, I think, the point here, is we got to apply our brains. And so it might get an output for us based on what we ask it. But if we're lazy and we don't give it the right prompt, it's not going to give us accuracy. I think that's what you're referring to. The other thing I think is that people get lazy on the other end, not just on the input, but on the output. It's just copying and pasting rather than actually reading what the output is and going, does this make sense? You know, curiously going, does this make sense? And this brings me back to your point around classroom education and the application of that theory as good practice. Now, I get the point because I've been there where I've been to classrooms and, as you say, you learn it. You get back to the office on the Monday morning, all's forgotten, but you got the nice shiny certificate, right? That's fantastic. Got another badge. But the point being is, one, maybe you don't have the opportunity to apply what you've learned. But if we be a bit challenging here, is the theory actually good practice? What do you think?
I don't think it's theory. I think a lot of the good practice that's documented is based on experience. It's another one of many random observations that you come to understand when you've been doing this for as long as I have. Every set of guidance and methodology, body of knowledge and all the rest of it that is out there originally was written by a team of two or three people. So prompt that became print, Bill Duncan working on the original PM body of knowledge, Richard Ferrer on the original APM body of knowledge. All of these things were written by a couple of people. So they're consistent, they have a common voice. The way the latest iterations of those documents are produced these days, when I was lead author for the APM's sixth edition body of knowledge, there were 3,000 contributions that I and one other had to combine into a single document with our brief was a single voice. So a lot of those contributions were conflicting, and we had to work through 3,000 and come up with something that was internally coherent and consistent.
How do you do that? We're all based on experience. Out of interest, how do you take? Yeah, they're all based on experience, as you say, and some of them are conflicting. For those that are, and certainly new to me, on the process of how you distill that into a single voice, how do you actually, what's the methodology, pardon the use of the word, that you use to come to that single voice with contradictory views, I guess, or experiences?
You have a hierarchy. So generally speaking, you will architect the structure of the document. So once you've got the topics that you believe make up the discipline of the functions that make up the discipline of project delivery, you then get all your contributions in on a function by function basis. And just speaking particularly with respect to the APM way of working on edition 6, I don't know how it worked on the 7th edition. On the 6th edition, we had all the special interest groups. So the risk SIG collated all the risk contributions. The procurement SIG collated all the procurement solutions. So they're responsible for dealing with contradictions within a topic and coming up as the special interest group with a view on that topic. Then it comes to the two of us who are putting it together, and we then had to reconcile conflicting views between the different SIGs. So one SIG may say something about, because you know, all these topics bleed into each other and they all have to work together. So you may get contradictions between what one SIG has said and what another SIG has said. And if you don't do that properly, and I've seen this in black and white, you get some ludicrous comments in a learned document like a body of knowledge. And that's sounds arrogant, but I'm saying, you know, that's not just my opinion. You read it and you say, that is just not real. I want to use a different word here, but it's not correct.
You can use whatever words you like, Adrian. No, it's great. And thank you for taking us through that, because like I said, I think a lot of our listeners won't appreciate how much work goes into distilling that information and bringing it together. So thank you to folks like yourselves for doing that in the first place, because it's no, you know, small task to do. And I guess from there, then the practical application piece of it, you know, as we say, we don't necessarily as practitioners will have the opportunities to go from classroom and apply exactly what we've learned. And one thing, don't tell him I said this, but Val is particularly good at, is asking the right questions given a scenario. So he'll go, you know, what should we be doing in this? How should we be doing it? What have we learned from it? You know, asking the right question. I don't think project practitioners necessarily ask the right questions at the right times. And it's that curiosity for me that is typically missing, because if you do ask yourself those questions, I think it will take you back to what you've learned in the classroom. But maybe there's other ways. Have you seen ways in which the classroom learned, not theory, but literature, shall we call it, is applied particularly well in practice, and why it was applied well?
There's various ways to answer that question. If I go back to the 90s, one of the things that we did, we worked with some big clients, people like Unilever and Lloyds Bank. And this was sort of before everybody wanted to get a certification. This was a world where it was more about let's learn how to manage a project rather than let's pass an exam. And what we used to do, it was probably the early 90s, we started doing simulations with Lego. So the way we taught a cohort of people to run projects was to come in, we'd give them a bit of theory, then we'd give them a scenario and break them up into teams, make those teams competitive because there was a prize at the end of the course. And then they had to manage a project, which in that case was building a house out of Lego. And the tutors would go from explaining the concepts and teaching the techniques to being horrible people, because they would play roles of architect, client, supplier, and a whole host of other roles, many of which they'd make up on the spot, all designed to make life as difficult as possible for the people who were trying to run the project. So I remember vividly one occasion when I was running one of those courses, and we'd just done a session on Tuckman, forming, storming, norming, performing, that kind of stuff, team building.
Yep.
And the team were then going through a phase of the project, and each of the teams had roles. And one of the guys' role was procurement. So you had the three members of the team sitting there building the house, keeping the plans up to date, and this other guy who has to go off to the stores and collect materials from the stores to bring back and be included in the build. For the tutors, this is a great opportunity to cause problems, because you would just make it really difficult for the guy. You'd give him the wrong materials. You'd suddenly become a policeman who did him for speeding on the way back to the site. Fine him, and you know that you had to make sure that fine went into the costs of the project and all that kind of stuff. But what happened with this fella was that we caused him so many problems that his three teammates got really upset with him and started to he started to become a member of the team. And at the end of the day, he actually came to me and said, "I've had enough of this. I don't like this course. I want to go home. This is ridiculous." So we just sat the four of them down and we talked through what had been happening. "Why are you three guys taking it all out on this one? Because he's not causing the problems. We're causing the problems. He's just the one who's having to come back and deliver the not very good message." So in situations like that, they don't just say, "Oh, yeah, that's some nice theory. That's a nice model." They actually feel it. "Yeah, we weren't very good there, were we? We didn't work as a team. We didn't find out what his problems were and how could we help him solve them." So, yeah, in terms of trying to get the message across, that's the kind of stuff we did in training courses, sort of getting on for 30 years ago. But in a lot of instances, that kind of course has been overtaken by much more theoretical ones. Theoretical is probably the wrong term, but you know what I mean. It's more about the knowledge than the practice.
And I think that's probably sad in a way, Adrian, because we've spoken to a lot of guests on this show, and mm-hmm. we talk a lot about behaviors, actions, attitudes, and communication skills. Call it soft skills, call it life skills, call it whatever skills you want, but the skills that aren't taught today in the classroom. Mm-hmm. And I love the fact that you share that anecdote, because it, you know, we've done it before, and why we stopped. And Val, I know you and I have done this a few times, and we've worked together in many guises and talked about not just the competency in terms of the theory, if you want to call it that, or the technicalities, but also how we work well together as teams. And I guess this one's for you, Val, because you're on the other side of the world. Do you see any differences, I guess, in the way training is done in Oz compared to the UK and the application thereof?
No, I would say the only clear difference is that it's less relied upon as a benchmark for competence. We kind of have the same setup as the UK, but there is a push to standardize. Adrian and Dale and Martin, they do have obviously certain sectors that are a lot more mature, so it's not like it's across the board, like oil and gas and mining and other areas where maybe defense are very, very mature. But where it comes undone is probably in the construction space, transport infrastructure, where they're just not quite sure how to implement standard baselines of training. So it's a hit and miss. But the other thing is to think about it from a from a top-down perspective, I mean, usually those training programs as well are a tick box for HR or people in culture or something. They go in and do these programs and they have a budget for the year, Adrian, and they say, all right, let's put these guys on some courses. And if the shoe fits, if there's enough budget, they'll put everybody on the course. We've had a challenge for a few times with speakers and people we've worked with around the paywalls around training. Because if one of the barriers, Adrian, is that people aren't educated, which probably is 100% right. Not educated, maybe the right way is probably the right way to say it. Then why is it so damn expensive? And is there an opportunity? And I know you work with Praxis, but how do we get then not misinformation, but the right information at the right price to the right people at the right time? How do we do that bit?
In order to answer that, I'd like to fold in a few other things, if I may. One of the issues that the project management has is fragmentation. So you send people on a course which is about the functions that make up the discipline of project management. It's body of knowledge based. It's a separate course if you want to talk about methodologies. It's a separate course for projects than it is for programs. There's this fragmentation. And if you actually need all this information, you need to understand the functions, stakeholder management, risk management, investment appraisal, leadership, teamwork, all that kind of stuff. You need to understand the functions. You also need to understand the project management process that those functions are used in. But because they're all, and projects and programs share 95% of their DNA. So, you know, they're like people and gorillas. We look very different, we act different, but 95% of our DNA is exactly the same. So, you know, if you go on a project course and then a program course, a lot of what you're doing is just duplication. And really what you only need is the 5% that's different. So when you get the thing about this fragmentation is that the different elements of it, you might do according to different standards. So you're then confronted with the further barrier of conflicting terminologies. Hang on a second. Is it a mandate? Is it a charter? Is it a project executive or a senior responsible owner? I don't know. All these different terminologies for the same things. So, you know, if I can indulge in what I've done to try and overcome these barriers, after I'd done the sixth edition of the APM book and then had the fortunate experience of retiring and having some time on my hands, I said, well, first thing we've got to do is to get rid of all this fragmentation. So we take method, knowledge, competency, organizational capability, maturity, and we put all those in a single, consistent, coherent framework. Same taxonomy, same terminology. Get rid of the fragmentation. So that was the motive behind creating the Praxis framework. So then what about the accessibility? What about, as you were saying, the costs of accessing that? Well, let's put it on the internet and make it free. You know, there's Wikipedia, there's all kinds of stuff. There's AI that will now go searching for this stuff for you that wasn't 10 years ago. But we said, let's put it all together and let's put it on the internet free. So no barrier in terms of different terminologies, no barriers in terms of having to buy a load of books and try and work out and try and translate between them. So what we then had was a framework which was integrated and free. You've still got the Monday morning problem. If people access that, doesn't mean they say they're going to apply it. And a bit of a watershed for me was reading this book. I don't know if you've come across this, it's the Checklist Manifesto. Atul Gawande is a surgeon. There's an excellent TED talk on YouTube that he's done about this book. To sum it up in a few sentences, He was asked to reduce surgical mortality and and post-op complications for the World Health Organization. It's a bit of a simple way of putting it, but he came up with a series of checklists. Now, who doesn't love a checklist? Especially if you're a surgeon. What? Especially when you put the chief scrub nurse in charge of the checklist. No, Mr. Surgeon, you can't cut any flesh until I've ticked all the boxes in this checklist. Sounds horribly bureaucratic. Maybe it is. All I would say in response is his process reduced mortality in surgery around the world by 40%. So you may hate a checklist, but there's a hell of a lot of people out there who are alive that might have been dead without this. After I'd read it, my daughter works in surgery. So I said, do you do a checklist before you start operating on somebody? So, yeah, it's standard practice. That's what we do. So I thought, well, if it's good enough for surgeons. So you sort of worked on this, and I thought, right, how do we get over this Monday morning problem? Well, you give people access, free access on the website to a checklist. Now, yeah, you've got to have buy-in from the organization, but I'm going to, they said something on Monday about business cases. I think I'll have a look at my project and see where we are on business case. I'm going to fill in this checklist on business case management. Yeah, done that. Oh, no, I haven't done that. Need to put that in place. Haven't done that. That's a good point. Risk management, I'm going to do the same. Procurement, investment appraisal, stakeholder management. Just going to run through these things and say, yeah, done that, haven't done that, got that, haven't got that. And that is what helps you start to embed what you've learned in the organization. And what happened after we started doing this is it became a bit of a snowball. Now, you guys know Donnie McNichol. Donnie said, look, I really like this. It's a great idea, making all this stuff free. And I've got this thing about the fact that all the current good practice out there assumes everybody perceives it and interprets it in the same way. But that's not the case. If you take something like the DISC model of, you know, put different personalities, dominant, conscientious, influential, you know, DISC, people who have different mixes of those character traits will read the same bit of good practice and interpret and implement it in different ways. And that is another one of the barriers, the fact that we think good practice is good practice. And I think everybody interprets good practice the same way I do, but they don't. So we then came up with this whole new section in Praxis that said, right, do yourself a DISC assessment. There's plenty of them free online. And when you understand what sort of blend you are between dominant and influential and conscientious, read this and it'll tell you how you're interpreting the good practice as opposed to how somebody else is interpreting the good practice. So that helps you come together. And then that checklist I was talking about, you make that 360. So people go in, and if every member of the team does the same checklist, you then get a report that says, you know what, you thought you were the mutts nuts at managing risk, but unfortunately, no, sorry, let's say you thought you were the mutts nuts at managing stakeholders. Well, your stakeholders filled in the same checklist, and they're not so convinced. So clearly, you need to have a conversation. So if you put these this understanding of different perspectives together with something that says, and here are your differences, this brings the team together to get a common view of how this good practice should be applied in a consistent way. And the last little twist of that is we made the checklist consistent with a capability maturity model based on the original CMMI model. So the individual fills in the checklist as a way of embedding that knowledge that they've gained in their day-to-day work. Other people fill in the same checklist and you find out where the differences of opinion are. You use what we call team praxis to understand those differences of opinion, and you come up with a plan to go forward. And because the checklists that all these people have been filling in are consistent with a capability maturity model, you just press another button and it tells you what the maturity score for your project is. And you do that from the bottom up. You know, traditionally, if you want to do a capability maturity assessment, it's a big set piece assessment, very expensive. It tells you you're rubbish at running programs. But the next stage is to design a program to implement change to get to the next level of maturity. But you already know you're not very good at running programs. So you muddle on with this expensive, long-winded program and then do another big assessment, expensive again, to find out if you've managed to get to the next level, which is just crazy. This approach says, we've sent all these people on courses. Monday morning, they start filling in the checklist. They start talking to their teams. They start getting consistent. They start applying it. And as a side product, we've got a real-time dashboard of how our capability maturity is increasing across the organization. And it's free. So this is how we started putting all these different elements together. And, you know, this is by no means something that we planned at the beginning. So the first objective was integrate all the different bits of the landscape. Integrate those. Be good if we made that free. Okay, let's make it free. Then somebody came along and said, be good if we had this different perspective for different personalities. Yeah, good idea. Let's do that. Tell you what, be great if we had a checklist, because I've read this book and it's really good. So let's have some checklists. Right? Yeah, done that. I know, let's make them 360. Yeah, okay, let's make them 360. And that fits in with the different personalities as well. Great. Now, because we base the questions on a maturity model, let's do some reports that tell you how your maturity of your organization is creeping up. So all these bits just sort of emerged from what we were doing. And I'll admit it's reverse engineering. So all these ideas of how to help people run their projects better, when I went back, I thought, yeah, this is addressing those problems that I talked about in the lessons learned reports. And it all sort of came together. And the idea of setting out, here are the barriers to embedding good practice and here are the solutions to embedding good practice, was something that emerged and grew. It wasn't an amazing plan right from the very start. Once you do some stuff and you see where it goes, it's amazing where it goes. So sorry, that was a bit long.
That's absolutely awesome, Adrian. No. It's great because I think it's comprehensive and gives people the full view. And I think, you know,
I'm not sure if Dale is there, but
it's about barriers.
Yeah, that's
it's easy to. I am here, Val. I think you can. You're the one that's having your internet troubles, but we'll crack on. And I think the key here for us is to actually focus on the solutions, as you say, and you've done that, Adrian, and we thank you and we commend you for that. But one of the things I think, if I draw out and look back, because look, we've spoken to you for the best part of an hour, and you know, I feel there's plenty more that you still can give, but I know you're very, very active, and I know people will reach out to you for more information. But for me, I think the key takeaways from what you've been saying today is, one, we've done a lot of this stuff before. We don't have to really reinvent the wheel, which is key. I particularly like, you know, the fact that you talk about how your training used to be in terms of looking at behaviors and team dynamics, and that's all lost, and we should bring that back. And I certainly think there are people that are bringing that back, which is great. I love the fact that, you know, you bring it just back to basics as well, and just say, you know, stop trying to outsmart ourselves, I think is what Val and I often say to each other. But most of all, I love your anecdotes. They're great. And I think you should be sharing those more often. So yeah, I just want to thank you for your time. But before we let you go, I do want to ask you, do you have any final thoughts that you want to leave with our listeners?
I would say, don't believe all the stuff about project failure. Don't get dispirited by all the stuff about project failure. Just look around you, walk out into the world and all the stuff that works really well, and consider that most of that was created by projects. And clearly they're making your life easier, more difficult in some ways, I would say, but you know, generally speaking, the world we live in was created by a lot of projects. So there are a lot of projects out there that succeed. And I would say it's not rocket science. The stuff that makes projects succeed is, a lot of it is pretty straightforward. And the analogy I often use is a sporting one. So, you know, in sporting terms, the love of my life is rugby. I've watched a lot. I've played a lot. I've watched my son play a lot. And if you go, you know, you go to the biggest rugby matches out there, and an hour ahead of the start of the game, these people who are at the absolute top of their game are running up and down the pitch, doing the exact same drills as the under sevens do on a Sunday morning at the local club. Because the basics are important and you've got to get the basics right. And you see them doing that time after time. And you know, when you don't see them doing it, they're out there in a field on a wet Wednesday night in the middle of winter, practicing the same basic skills. The fancy stuff, yeah, that happens on the day. So a lot of what goes wrong with projects is not doing the basics. So if we can sort of neatly wrap the whole thing up now at the end from what we said at the beginning, it's the stuff like, I should have involved the business stakeholders at the start. One springs to mind, I didn't write down here. It said, it would have been good if we'd understood the requirements at the start of the project. So the courses teach you these basics. Things like Praxis give you access to information about these basics. And it's not just the individuals who have to apply them, it's the people around them who have to give them space to apply it. So project managers, talk to the people in your organization, convince them to give you the space to apply these basics. Okay, they might want that report written by 3 o'clock this afternoon, but you need some space to actually apply these simple approaches that you've learned on a training course. And unless they give you that space, it isn't going to happen. So it's not complicated. You need to do the wet Wednesday nights to practice the basics, and the people around you need to give you the opportunity to apply them. And then I think we can really make a difference instead of getting wrapped up in all sorts of highfalutin theories and more complicated silver bullets. Yeah, it's not rough. If I could perhaps, sorry, if I leave you with one anecdote. In my previous life, I was writing a Prince course, and it was a distance learning, self-guided learning course. And my wife was proofreading it for me. My wife has no background in project management at all. She was in healthcare. And she was reading this proofreading, this material I was writing for our company. So we sat in the same office. She looked up. She said, people buy this stuff off us. I said, well, yeah. Is it that bad? What's the problem? No. She said, it's pretty good, but it's also pretty obvious common sense, isn't it? I said, yeah. So people pay us to teach them common sense. I said, yeah. Okay. And she carried on. And, you know, that's it, really.
Brilliant. I love that story. And it's a great way to end the pod, Adrian. I also echo your sentiment of, you know, projects and failures, because I've not met a single project professional that actually actively goes out there to fail on a project. So we're all trying to do the right thing. And I think together, the more we share, the more we communicate, the more we provide each other with challenge and perspective in the right ways, the more we can grow as a profession and a community. So thank you so much for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure and privilege to have you on the Project Chatter podcast.
Thank you very much for the invitation. I really enjoyed it.
The pleasure is all ours, as I say. So, folks, there you have it. That is the end of this episode. But please remember, do help us pay it forward and share a link to this episode on your favorite social media. Once again, a massive thank you to our guest, Adrian Dooley. And thank you all for listening. Till next time, we say stay safe, be disruptive, and have fun doing it. From me, Val, and Martin, it's bye for now.
Project Chatter supports and is a member of Zero Construct. Zero Construct is a new working group that wants to lower carbon construction. Not everyone will be aware, but construction contributes to around 12 to 15% of total carbon emissions.
This is a staggering amount, and we need to reduce it. We are a growing community of people that want to help make this change. Everyone is welcome, whether you're an engineer, contractor, or consultant. You just need to want to make a difference.
Our aim is to grow a network of experts so we can all learn from each other and make a positive impact in the places where we work. We'll do this by sharing knowledge and making it accessible in engaging ways.
To join us and find out more, please visit zeroconstruct.com and register as a member. Thank you, and we look forward to speaking with you soon.
For more information, blogs, or to support our charities, visit projectchatterpodcast.com. And if you would like to sponsor the podcast, get in touch via our website.
You can also leave us a voice message via our anchor page and let us know if there's something or someone specific that you would like on the podcast.
The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this podcast belong solely to the participating individuals and not necessarily to the individual's employer, organization, committee, or other group or individual. Additionally, any views or opinions are not intended to malign any religion, ethnic group, club, organization, company, or individual.